you know, I think at the very beginning of the process of figuring out what you want, you have to say, do I want the whole trade-off that other people have made? Do I really want all of the downsides that go with those particular upsides? I think that's such a liberating place to begin. You really immediately push past that totally false and unhelpful thinking and instead say, look, what is it I was built to do, born to do? What did I come here to do? What's the right set of work that I maybe even uniquely can bring to the world? You know, to me, that's the essential path. That's what it means ultimately to be an essentialist.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Greg, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
It's great to be with you.
It is my pleasure to have you here. So I have been, as I was saying before we officially hit record here, a huge fan of your book, Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. It's one of those books that I return to over and over again. I think it's in the same vein as Cal Newport's book, Deep Work, but I think it really sets us up to focus on the most important things in our lives. But before we get into your work around essentialism, I want to start by asking you, what did your parents do for work and how did that end up shaping and influence the choices you made throughout your life and career?
My father was an entrepreneur. He ran his own small carpet and upholstery business. That was for the majority of the time I was growing up. And before that was in sales. My mother was a full-time stay-at-home mom and then later did respite care. I think that one way that shaped what I've chosen to do is that very early on, I wanted to be entrepreneurial myself. My first business was at 10 years old, washing cars, and was actually quite a profitable business, certainly getting better money than anything else I could have done at the time in Leeds, England, where I was raised. And I think it began a lifelong interest in the idea that that effort and reward are not linearly related. Mm-hmm. That you could, I could have done at the time a milk round, get up at 4 in the morning. I think they paid £1 or £2 per hour, and you do that for hours every, 3 times a week. I mean, that's a job, and that was very hard to get that job, and I could earn, 5 or 6 times that in my own business on my own hours, and the satisfaction of doing it how you wanted to do it. That was an important contrasting moment. And again in my life, I have tried, no matter how complex of a situation I was faced with, whether I'm consulting at Apple or indeed writing Essentialism, whatever I'm trying to build, I tend to go back to that first entrepreneurial experience to just remove all of the unnecessary complexity. Who is your customer? What are you doing for them? What's the major competitor they could go to? These simple questions cut through the clutter and I think have helped me to be able to be useful to companies that I have worked with and also individuals that I've tried to apply those lessons too.
So I want to come back to this idea of effort and reward. One thing I wonder is, did your parents, as you were growing up, encourage and nurture this entrepreneurial instinct? And also culturally in the UK, what did you notice as differences in sort of the narrative around choosing entrepreneurial careers versus America? Because I know, I've talked about on the show before, Indian parents are like hell, you're going to become an entrepreneur, go become a doctor, lawyer, engineer. And I know you were actually headed to law school at one point.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, England, there's no equivalent in England of the lemonade stand that's so, prevalent within the US. And that's more than just symbolism. I mean, when you have an experience, when you're young, my children have done it more than once, but not so very long ago, you know, came together. They did a whole thing. It took them the whole day. They made it, you know, they did it beautifully. They went out, they earned the money. I mean, you have an actual experience and the community supports it because you value this and you recognize it. The contrast for me is that in the UK, I never found people adamantly against being an entrepreneur or taking a path less traveled. But I found people would say, well, why would you do that? Why would you want to do that? So it's deeper baked assumptions against doing things differently. And of course, that's worked fairly well for the United Kingdom. You know, it's almost 1,000 years of uninterrupted freedom. So stability has a high value. But nevertheless, for me, in ways I didn't know when I was younger, it was really important to, I didn't have words for it when I was younger. It was really important to be able to have the freedom to challenge how it was done, to look at how it might be done differently, better in the future. We went to Disneyland, you know, one of the times we went to Disneyland with our children, we took one of these tests where you find out which Disney character you are. And I can't remember his name now, but he's the inventor in A Bug's Life, who actually gets all sorts of things wrong in his inventions until he like figures out how to really do it well. And that surprised me at first. It wasn't probably the person I most wanted to be, but I loved it in hindsight because it's the story of this person who just doesn't see the world the same as other people. And so, yes, I was you know, if I followed the traditional education system, despite this other deeper desire to do things differently in ways I perceived as better or more efficient, game-changing ways. And so it turned out I was at law school studying, and I'd remember. But whenever we talked about educational plans with my father, what he'd really said to me was, you know, go to law school because that will keep your options open. So it was a traditional path that was being recommended, and I was there and I got in, and that itself is its own achievement. So, of course, once you're there, you don't necessarily think, your first instinct isn't, okay, well, let's not do this now. It wasn't that I absolutely hated the experience, but I didn't feel this sense of mission with it. I didn't feel this sense of alignment, a sense of, yes, I want to be doing this every moment. So, well, I had some friends in the United States, and I came out to visit with them. And in being here, I started to feel this sense of, my goodness, you could live here. You could have a completely different kind of life. And that was in the back of my mind when I met with somebody established, potential mentor sort of figure. And they said, look, Greg, if you do decide to stay in America, then you should come and help me do A, B, and C. And although I had the surface level imagined, oh, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if you could be here? It wasn't until he said that, assuming it really could be done, really emotionally affirming that you can live a different kind of life. You can choose not to go down the path that you were on before. That I left his office and I literally took a piece of paper from somebody's desk and I brainstormed, what would you do if you could do anything? And at the end of that 20-minute brainstorm, I notice critically, not what I've written down, but what I haven't written down. That law school is not on the list. So, yeah, that's the key moment, because you say, well, right, I'm doing this now. From that moment, to continue to do it means you're doing something you know you wouldn't do if you could do anything. You know that there is a misalignment. And of course, there's an argument to be made for, we'll go back, finish it, and then decide what to do. And I'm not knocking other people that choose that. But for me, it was too incongruent to do that. And so there was no, from that moment on, there was no putting my life back into its original packaging.
Yeah,
it wasn't going to fit anymore.
That raises two questions for me. You know, this is something that I've asked multiple people, and there's, I think, you know, this notion, and this is a very American thing. There's a book that really caught my attention recently. I don't remember the author's name, but it was titled, you know, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking is Undermining America. And podcasts like mine, books like yours, podcasts like Tim Ferriss, things like the 4-Hour Workweek have encouraged us to buy into this narrative that anything is possible for anybody. And I had a mentor who challenged that, and he said, that's simply not true. He said that, you know, what we're doing is we're confusing probability and possibility. Like, the probability that I'm going to play in the NBA with LeBron is literally zero. So, you know, as somebody who writes books in this genre, I wonder, you know, and somebody who has, you know, one, taught at an elite school and also been at an elite school, what do you say to that? Because not everybody is going to graduate from Stanford. I mean, I often think that, wow, what about the role that luck played in my getting to write a book with Penguin? Like, we don't acknowledge that because it sounds obnoxious to say it.
Well, I certainly don't think anyone can do everything. So that's like a pretty first important principle in creating a counterweight to the, I think, false narrative that that, well, if you put your mind to it, anything is doable, anything is achievable. You know, I think that you can achieve extraordinary things, but certainly not everything. And one of the first things one needs to do is to recognize that, so that you can take that burden off. And instead of trying to do everything for everyone that you've ever imagined or anyone else has achieved, yeah, that's all just burden. Instead, you say, what is my essential and unique mission in life? What is it that I came here to do? Let's take off all of that unnecessary yoke. I remember one of my sisters-in-law, when she was younger, before she was married, had this idea. I remember distinctly talking to her about it. I think probably she talked about it more than once with me. She was searching for her future husband, and she wanted her husband to just be as athletic as this brother. That wasn't me. As funny as this brother. That was also not me. I think she was like, as intellectual as you are, which wasn't even such a compliment. And on it went. That's all she wanted. She just wanted the best of everyone that she was close to. That's what she was looking for. And I think that's exactly what we do when we get into this comparison process, this fear of missing out, this jealousy that is inevitable when this thinking takes place. We just want to be as talented in basketball as LeBron, like you just said, as famous as Kanye, as rich as, you know, Bill Gates. I think at the very beginning of the process of figuring out what you want, you have to say, do I want the whole trade-off that other people have made? Do I really want all of the downsides that go with those particular upsides? And that's a very, like, I think that's such a liberating place to begin. So that you really immediately push past that totally false and unhelpful thinking, and instead say, look, what is it I was built to do, born to do? What did I come here to do? What's the right set of work I maybe even uniquely can bring to the world? You know, to me, that's the essential path. That's what it means ultimately to be an essentialist. It's not just to do fewer things better. It is that. But at a deeper level, it's to do the few things you are really supposed to do. And so life becomes figuring out what that is, eliminating what it isn't, and trying to design a life that makes it possible, doable, even easy to go down that path. So to me, that path is achievable. You know, that path is something that is not just a peripheral thought. I think it's the very work of life.
You know, that it brings two things to mind. I had a mentor who started working with me when we rebranded. You know, we started out as this podcast for bloggers. He came to work with me in 2013, fundamentally changed the entire direction of my life. And he said, I remember, I think a month into working with me, I'd been doing freelance work where I was, you know, managing social media for a pro surfer. I'd helped somebody market a book. And he said, do you want to be doing any of this in 5 years? And I said, no. He said, then stop doing all of it now. And I was like, wow. And then, you know, we had Justine Musk, Elon Musk's ex-wife here. And, you know, I'm glad you brought up sort of the trade-off thing, because she said, when I asked her, I said, what is it that we don't? She said, people don't see the amount of work that actually goes into these accomplishments. She's like, you know, it's one thing to believe that these people work hard, but she said, these kinds of accomplishments often come literally at the cost of everything else in your life.
Exactly. So next time you feel jealous of somebody, just say, do I want the full trade-off? Now, that's not an excuse to not fulfill the mission you have within you, but it should be enough to interrupt this hero worshiping, this berating of self when our life doesn't look like somebody else who's made completely different trade-offs in order to achieve what they've achieved. I remember when I was first, you know, writing Ascensions, maybe it had just come out, and I could see so many of my, you know, colleagues maybe writing a second book, or they would have a whole coaching business, or they're just doing all sorts of interesting things. And the pull within me at times to do those things was real. But then you go forward a few years and you just go, yes, but I have loved these trade-offs. I pick these trade-offs again. I pick that I've been able to be singular about this subject that matters so much to me. I pick that it's kept me, you know, honest about spending time with my own family. One of my things I've done recently, and it's grown out of essentialist thinking, is that at 5 o'clock at night, so even in COVID times, at exactly at five, I leave the office, my office at home, and I announce loud to the whole family what time it is. So if it's 4:59, they know it. If it's 5:03, they know it. And it's this accountability moment. I love these trade-offs. I love that what has followed this set of trade-offs is that it is literally true that my children are best friends with each other, and that I am too, and that my wife is as well, that we genuinely want to be together. That only can happen through day in, day out trade-offs. And so you've got to, how would you say it? You've got to want what you really want.
So I think this will actually make a perfect jump off point for getting into essentialism. So you have this moment, you know, where you get into law school, but what you say is that you don't feel a sense of mission or purpose. And I think there are so many people who don't feel that, you know, in moments just like that, but unlike you, they don't act on it. Why not?
I don't think that it's really it doesn't feel possible to them. It might be logically true that they could do something different, but emotionally, it doesn't feel true. And for me too, I mean, I have a lot of compassion, because for me, I had to be in a different continent, different country, talking to somebody new I'd never even talked to before, given this outside perspective in an outside place, and to suddenly feel emotionally possible. Oh, I could do it. And this after, you know, a lifetime of maybe trying to take a different path anyway. So I'm very sympathetic to the challenge that's at hand here. And I think that when people think of it, they're pulled towards a sense of, oh, I want to do what's a sense, you know, purposeful for me. But the counterweight is, you know, the amygdala and the fear reaction that's in our brain whenever we try to make a big change. So what I would encourage people to do now, with a few years of hindsight, have studied this and looked at how people change and don't change, is to go so small, so simple, so easy, you can't fail. So literally you say, okay, right, you're in this job you don't really want to be in, you're in this place you don't want to be, whatever, right? So it's quite dramatic things somebody could wake up to. Don't worry about all of this. Take 1 minute a day to research something you actually do want to do, you know, to study what a career in that would be like, or to look at, you know, how what an entrepreneur's business would be like. I mean, the tiniest thing. And in this way, I think you can almost trick the amygdala. You can get around the fear response. It's like let it be asleep over there as you just try a tiny experiment in exploration towards something that matters to you, and let that build very naturally, unforced over time, the thin end of the wedge, and use that to grow into, I understand a bit more now. It seems a little more possible than it did yesterday. And I think that incremental approach can be very powerful.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I think as a society, we tend to glorify the sort of dramatic risk-taking. And, you know, people who take incremental approaches don't get that glory or the press. But I think if you actually go and deconstruct any of these stories, they actually tend to be very incremental in how they actually come together.
I think that's been true for me completely. Even where I share a story like quitting law school, and of course it does sound dramatic, and in a sense it is. I mean, I didn't go back to law school. I didn't go back to the. I should have done, but I didn't even say, "Hey, I'm dropping out." I just went, "Okay, that's over. I'm moving forward." So in a sense, it's a dramatic shift. But this had been building day after day after day. This was not just completely out of the blue. I had, since I was very young, the same time as I was being an entrepreneur, I had images. I didn't have words for it, but images of teaching in the future. I wanted to, I could imagine teaching. And certainly by the time I was a teenager, I was actively reading literature that typically people wouldn't read maybe till 30s or 40s or later, you know. So I'm reading the success literature, the wisdom literature. I was fascinated by that stuff. I'd met with and talked to people that had written these books. So it was definitely there. I just hadn't realized, look, you can just start this now. You can get on with this now. You don't have to wait for 20 years and then do what it is that you're feeling. You know, it's similar to that lovely story you just described. Well, stop doing it now. That was the breakthrough moment. But it was actually still incremental before and even afterwards. You know, when I went back to England after quitting law, I spent that summer reading, writing, researching. I mean, I just began the quiet work. There was no applause. There was no social media at that time. So there wasn't even that kind of instant thing where you could start microblogging. Even the internet as we think of it basically wasn't around. So I just started reading, writing, willing a new kind of life. And it's been this great adventure. I love as much today. I got up early this morning and was writing and researching and working on a new book now. And I enjoyed that as much today as I did these more than 20 years ago, researching and writing then. This is discovering the thing that does feel so natural and really actually easy for you compared to how it is for other people. This is one of the good tests that you're getting closer to what your unique and highest contribution is.
Well, I think that makes a perfect segue into essentialism. But where I want to start actually is with the fact that you've taught in a university. And, you know, when I look back to Berkeley, and I've mentioned this before, I felt like the way that my potential choices for what to study were basically presented to me as a fast food menu. It was like, these are your options. Choose from the ones in front of you. But what I now, you know, with hindsight, I'm like, wow, the options in front of you blind you to the possibilities that surround you. You're somebody who writes about choice. Why is that? Like, and you know, and specifically in the context of education, as somebody who is taught in one of the most elite universities in the world, how do we begin to unwind that narrative? What does the future of this look like?
Look, the educational systems were designed in the Industrial Revolution. I mean, before that, there was no mass education. So once there was enough means to be able to provide an education for the masses, and that there was a just even the possibility, because machines increasingly took the role of well, basically child labor. You know, so suddenly there is the emergence, the possibility of education for a lot of people. And we applied the industrial age thinking to the way a school would work. So it's not just universities, it's the entire the entire formal education system is built on these assumptions that are largely invisible to us now. But I mean, this is the separation of subjects. The separation of subjects was far less established prior to the to mass education. When you go back and read, you know, about Newton in Principia Mathematica, this absolute phenomenon, 2-year treaties that pushed our thinking forward in the laws of motion and physics incomprehensibly. He didn't do it in any way that remotely follows how a traditional education experience would be. He went in solitude. That's the first huge difference. He was doing deep work. He was doing essential, focused work. He had questions he was trying to answer. That's the first thing. The next thing, he's completely combining subjects. There's no separation of truth for him. So truth can be circumscribed for him into one great whole, and he's just trying to understand how that ecosystem of truth works together, how all of that motion works together. That is, again, completely different than the industrial age system, where we separate it all up. Math is in this building. You know, history is in that classroom. Music exists over here. I mean, that isn't how the world is. That's just one way of trying to understand the world. But it was like a factory-based system. You go from this piece to, you know, of the machine, of the automated process into this piece, and we're trying to efficiently take lots of people through it. We're going to have you sit in rows just like a factory. We're going to have one person at the front telling you, you know, what to think. I mean, none of this is actually really even very close to how a natural learning about the world would take place. And both the work that I did when I was teaching at Stanford, where I was co-designed a class on designing life, essentially, in that literal work, what we were trying to do there, and then in my own efforts now, unexpected as they turn out to be, my wife and I decided that we would homeschool our children, even though we'd never been homeschooled. In fact, in my podcast, my first episode of the new podcast, Essentialism Podcast, is talking with my wife Anna about the birth of essentialism, what went on in the background, and so we touch upon some of these unexpected journeys we've been on. So, you know, we tie all that together. It's that what we want for our children, what I wanted for my students at Stanford, what I want for people who read Essentialism, is to remove all of that non-essential clutter that gets in the way of the real work. I described it earlier on in this conversation, the work of life. We suddenly realized, well, we want our children not to wait until their mid-20s or mid-30s to start asking the right questions. I mean, if you wait, I mean, what a shame it is to wait till you're in your mid-30s in a career with responsibilities, with a mortgage, to suddenly say, well, what am I really here for? What am I really, what's my unique contribution? What's my mission? What is it all about? What can I uniquely do in the world that maybe no one else can do? I mean, what a shame to wait that long. So with our own children, we've encouraged these questions. And I remember I'll give you, this is within the last month, talking with my son who wanted previous to this conversation, he's 14 years old. Previous to this conversation, if you asked him what he wanted to do with his life, he would have said, well, either an engineer or a handyman. Which is to say that he has observed that he loves to understand how things work, and he's really good at it too. And so then we started researching a little together online, and over the course of about, I don't know, an hour or so, we clarified together that what he wants to be is a biotech engineer specializing in medical devices. To me, the advantage, what happened once we were reading it specifically about that, he sat back in this chair, he laid back, and his eyes closed, and his whole body just relaxed. And I said, when I see that in you, what I think is that you feel home. And he just, without opening his eyes, he said, yes, Dad, that's how it feels. And to me, that was such a magical moment.
Yeah.
These are in no way my strengths. I have no agenda for him to be this. I'm not trying to mold him into something that I want. I'm not trying to put him through a factory-based system. I don't want him to be, you know, an author like I've chosen to be. I want exactly the opposite. I want him to find his unique and essential mission. And that's what I want to encourage for, you know, when I was teaching at Stanford, it was helping people to design a life around the things that they could uniquely contribute. And to not pay any attention, no comparison, no competition with the person sitting next to them. We want each person to find and to fulfill the measure of their creation. And so whether that's a biotech engineer, whether it's an author, of personal growth, leadership, and strategy principle, you know, that doesn't matter. It's about finding that voice and bringing it forth in the world.
Yeah. So one thing you said is to become an essentialist requires a heightened awareness of our ability to choose. We need to recognize it as an invincible power within us, existing separate and distinct from any other thing, person, or force. And I think that the reason that I'd highlighted that in particular is because of the current situation we're in. I get the sense that a lot of people right now actually feel incredibly powerless because of you know, the circumstances they're in due to a pandemic that is completely out of their control. So in the wake of something like this, where we're dealing with a situation that is out of our control, and it's not like we're never going to experience situations that are out of our control again in our lives, they happen consistently. What do you say to them?
I would share a story with them. So not long ago, my family and I moved into a really lovely community, white picket fences, no street lamps, horse trails. My children got to spend these long days outside with our happy dog, the riding horses. I mean, it is planting a garden, apple trees, grapevines. We really just living in this little piece of heaven on earth together. One of our daughters, Eve, seemed especially to thrive. She's a slim, brown-eyed, brown-haired girl, mischievous grin. She cannot stay cross for half a second. Even if she tries to, she just bursts into laughter. She's always climbing trees, running barefoot all over the place, wrestling with her brothers, catching lizards. This is her life. Reading books, animated all the time, writing in a journal, animated, scintillating conversation, just punctuated with laughter all the time. This is Eve. Then she turned 14, hit a growth spurt, and felt tired a lot. Talked to us less, took longer to do her chores. So that pretty age-appropriate behavior, or so we thought. On a routine visit with a physical therapist, he noticed that Eve didn't respond properly to a basic reflex test. And so he took my wife, Anna, aside and said, look, you might want to see a neurologist about this. And he, of course, we didn't need to be told twice. So from that point on, her symptoms worsened from know, a daily basis. Within just a few weeks, she could answer in only one word sentences with a slurred monotone voice, right hand side of her body responding slower than the left. Took, you know, 2 full minutes to write her own name, hours to eat a meal. And the light, once so vibrant and bright in Eve, dimmed. And then seemed to go out entirely when she was hospitalized with a major seizure. So what made the situation worse is through all this time, the doctors couldn't explain anything. They could not offer us even the beginning of a diagnosis. Every day, we're going to more respected neurologists, look at us with furrowed brows. One instance, he literally shrugged his shoulders, test, more test, everything. All of them come back negative. They don't even have a clue. And so we're just watching our vivacious daughter in an almost constant state of freefall and, you know, no explanation at all. And then this is the stuff that, you know, true stuff, suffering is made of. And in moments like this, where everything's out of our control, we really have sort of two choices. You can take a hard, out of control situation and focus on what you can't do anything about, let it consume you, body and soul. You basically take a hard situation and make it much harder. Or you can focus on what you can do something about, which might be very reduced items. You know, at first we thought, well, we just need to attack this problem full force, all directions, 24/7, go to every neurologist in the country, ask a million questions, kill ourselves in all-nighters, Googling for a cure, poring over medical journals. I mean, just all of this, just near superhuman effort on the one side. But the problem, if you take that approach, we found, you know, quickly that your approach is unsustainable and you produce disappointing results. And in the end, you just feel like giving up. And so mercifully, we saw it differently. And we realized the best way to help her was not by exerting more and more effort. Indeed, it was quite the opposite, because if your job is to keep the fires burning for an indefinite period of time, you can't throw all the fuel on the flames, so to speak, at the beginning. You need to take the long journey. So what we did, at least, is we there were just so many things we didn't do. And in times of uncertainty and when things are out of control, I think that the things we didn't do could be informative. We didn't torture ourselves with unanswerable questions. We didn't worry ourselves sick about whether this was terminal. We didn't complain that the doctors didn't have the answers. We didn't live in denial or tell ourselves, oh, it's not so bad. We didn't try to force the timetable. We didn't try to say, why us, become all, you know, woe is us about it. We didn't dissect every article people were sending us to. Some of those things are awful that they sent. Quite ill-informed, well-intended, but not so. We didn't try to do it all alone. This, to me, this is removing all of these things when you can't control a situation is so important, because you want to be able to sustain your effort and focus on the things you can. What we did instead was focus on the really simple things, essential things, but easy things. We got around the piano and sang. We went on walks. We read books together. We played games. We looked for the positive and pointed it out. We ate dinner together, told stories, toasted each other, laughed all the time. We were grateful, and we did these things each day. And what we noticed is that there's almost a magical force at play. We no longer felt overwhelmed, less exhausted. We didn't burn out. And it's been 2 years now, and we've seen amazing results, and we still have the energy to keep going. So we've watched our daughter wither into a shell of her former self and return from it. Of course, there's been medical procedures involved, but
she continues to get better. It's still ongoing, but we have reason to believe she'll be completely healed. And she smiles, laughs, jokes. She walks, runs, wrestles. She reads, writes. She's thriving again. Indeed, she has not only made up for lost time, she's on target to graduate high school some 2 years early. So what if I could summarize all of that, I would simply say this. If you focus on what... I'll say it this way. I do not think for one moment that we would have endured it, far less thrived through it, if we had done it the hard way. If we'd been consumed and tried to carry the burden of things we could not control. The situation was hard enough without us making it harder. And what I learned from that experience is I just discovered a whole different way to do life, a way that eases life's inevitable burdens.
Wow. Well, thank you. That was beautiful. And it actually makes a perfect segue / return to something you brought up earlier, which is this, you know, nonlinear relationship between effort and reward. And something you say later in the book is that while the industrial era is long behind us, the more structures and systems continue to pervade most modern organizations. And, you know, I remember, I think part of the reason I highlighted that is that I felt that that was my entire experience of corporate America, where it was very clear that the appearance of effort mattered more than the actual results that you were generating, which is why I didn't last very long at any job. And yet, here we are, it's 2020. I think the only reason we are now officially finally realizing that you don't need to be at work for 8 hours a day and you can work from somewhere else is because we have to. How do we actually undo what, you know, Aaron Dignan, who was a former guest here, he said that they have this sort of these operating systems that exist within organizations, and most of them are outdated. We're effectively running modern day organizations in 2020 on whatever the Windows version was before Windows 95.
Yes. I mean, I do agree. I think that as we went from the agrarian age to the industrial age, I mean, 80-90% of the jobs and all the work that went with them disappeared and were replaced. Drucker talks about it being a 50x increase in productivity that took place in that transition. He said the big challenge of, you know, our times, of this new age as we go from the industrial age to a knowledge age, is to again remove all the old systems and create a new system that, again, increases productivity by 50x. Now, since he laid down that gauntlet of we haven't achieved it. We are still in transition. And it will happen. I think the forces are at play that make them effectively inevitable. But right now we're still in the that transition period, and we still have all of the old systems and structures and burdens of a way of doing things where the asset was labor and machines. Well, now that's not what it is. It's not an efficiency system anymore. That was efficiency. It was just how quickly can you get a thing through this process. But we're not doing that anymore. That once you move to knowledge work, the value, the promise, the possibility is a person's ability to create value. And so what to do is the primary question. What work is to be done? What's the right thing to be done? And I think essentialism can play an important role in helping to lubricate that transition from industrial age to this higher value knowledge age. Because essentialism, although it is often and frequently put with as a productivity book, a productivity idea, I think it's a complete misrepresentation. Productivity, at least traditional productivity, is about doing, you know, doing stuff, getting stuff done as efficiently as possible. That's industrial age. Essentialism, you know, might be more like the first productivity book of the new age, because what you're saying instead is is get the right things done. Well, the difference between doing things, getting things done, and getting the right things done is really different. But that's the difference between, you know, thinking that you're in a coal mine and suddenly waking up and realizing you're in a diamond mine. Well, the whole skill set is different. Your ability to discern what matters, what is disproportionately valuable, is like a huge part of the skill set. That might be the most important skill set of the 21st century. Your ability to find those diamonds, those things that matter, that's completely different than an industrial system where the what is already spoken for. That's already been decided, and your job is just to do the piece that you're given as efficiently as possible. So this new possibility, the new age, you know, what an essentialist can do if they set their lives up right, is that they can create space to discern what is essential, the few things that really matter. They can develop the skills to be able to negotiate out of the things that don't matter. And then they can build a new system that makes it easy and efficient to do the things that really are valuable. That's essentialism. That's the concept of what essentialism is. And I think it's a critical mindset in order to be able to make good on the promise that Drucker was talking about.
Wow. Okay. So, we've been dancing around a lot of this with a lot of theory, and I think I want to make sure that, you know, our listeners get some very tactical things here as well, just because the theory part is what I was curious about. One of my favorite concepts is, you know, what you brought up about selection criteria. You say that making our criteria both selective and explicit affords us a systematic tool for discerning what is essential and filtering out the things that are not. And I remember reading that because one of the challenges that I was running into was I would get pitches from podcast guests and I would sit around deliberating whether I wanted this person or not. And then I remember your scale rule from the Stanford class of 7 to 10. And if they weren't, you know, if they're below 7, they were an immediate no. And I literally did that, you know, and put a column inside of my Airtable and said, okay, is this a hell yes or no? And if it was not a hell yes, I was like, okay, great. This person's not going to be a guest. Can you talk about how we might apply that to other parts of our lives?
Fundamentally, it's the 90% rule. So you're instead of getting lost in the middle, evaluating endlessly, you know, all these good things and possible things you could be doing, you're using just a stricter rule. In my own life, I came up a couple of years ago with you know, three rules that I was following to just immediately be able to say yes and no to the things that came along. And that's what people can do. You actually make it explicit. You write down rules for what I'm saying yes to, rules for what I would say no to. And the process of just coming up with those is an important part of becoming an essentialist, because you start to say, you know, so it's a bit like the closet metaphor where if you go into your closet to tidy it out because it's too much stuff in there, you can easily leave almost everything untouched by the end of the process. And you've tidied it, but you didn't get rid of anything. You didn't, because your criteria was something like, could I ever possibly wear this again in the future? Maybe. And the answer to that question is yes. Of course it's possible. So the criteria is so broad, nothing comes out of the closet. So what would a more selective question be? Have I worn it in the last 6 months? I mean, for some people, that's like a third of their closet is out. Seriously. Then you could say, okay, do I look good in it? Another 20% is gone. we could use Marie Kondo's question. We could say, does it spark joy? That's more like a 90th percentile question, because the answer to almost everything will be no. And that's why it's such a useful question, and why it's proved to be so useful for so many people. Because what you want to be left with is only the things that you love to wear, that fit you now, that you wear often. And once your closet is like that, when you walk into it, it's like a breath of fresh air. You walk in and you just you love it. Everything. Oh, I just want to be here. I want to be able to. I can find what I want quickly. Everything I have on the shelf is good. I have some space now for something new to come into my closet, some new item that I could get and add to to the clothes here, something new. Of course, this is just the metaphor, but for our own lives, as we start, I think for many, many people, the criteria for their life is as broad as the one we started with there with the closet. It's just like, is it in my inbox? I mean, that's a sufficient criteria for them to be doing stuff. Is it, is someone else doing this? Yeah. Have I ever thought in the past I should do it? Could this thing do some good possibly? But these questions are so broad, the answer has to be yes. And that's literally why people, they just live in their inboxes. They become a slave to not just to their to-do list, although that can happen, but to this massive mental to-do list in their head. I just had David Allen on the Essentialism podcast, and he talked about this. He said that the most recent research is that you can only hold two things in your brain at the same time, in your mind, the RAM of your mind. Two. Beyond two, you have cognitive deterioration. I mean, when I first applied, not in this interview in conversation with him, but previously when I read about his work, when I first got everything out of my head, you know, the closet of my mind, there were 400, this is literally true, 400 things that were just sitting there. And I'm trying to go through life with 400 things in my mind. And all sort of vying for your attention. Once I got all of that out, just like the closet, get it all out. You know, now your closet's empty, your mind's empty, it's all now outside, it's lying on the bed, you know, all the stuff from your closet. And you go through each item and you're saying, is this essential? Why do I think this ought to be done? What's the outcome that it serves me? You evaluating item after item, what would done look like? And so you go through a process one by one so that you can rid yourself of as many of these tasks as possible. And as you do that, you end up with a life that, oh my goodness, it feels doable. It's not so burdened, not so heavy, because we're just doing the things that really, you know, the right and correct path for me. Now, this all sounds so idealistic, I know that, but we've got to get clear about what the definite yeses are for us, because if you don't have a point of view, you can't advocate for yourself. You can't lead your way on the team you're currently on or your business down a path that is one that you want to be on. And so, yes, you can't just go from point A to point B. I know what is 90% yes for me, and now I'm going to say no to everything else immediately without consequence. No, you can't do that. But neither can you live a life full of just the 90% and above essential work if you don't know what it is, if you haven't done any selective evaluation. And so as with the closet, as with the mind, so with all of the decisions in your life, you start to look at it not through a dark lens of non-essentialism, which lies to us and makes us believe that everything is of equal importance. We take off that lens. Essentialism isn't putting on a lens, it's taking off the funny glasses so you can see clearly. And suddenly, as you do that, you say, goodness, hardly any of this stuff matters to me. It might matter to my neighbor. It might matter to so-and-so. It might matter to somebody online. It might matter to somebody on Instagram, but it doesn't matter to me. It might have mattered to me a year ago, but it doesn't matter anymore to me. And as we discover that, We're suddenly liberated from all of these heavy layer upon layer of expectations that no longer serve us. And we're free to move forward.
Wow. So it's funny because I realized I could talk to you for another 2 hours based on how much more depth there is in this book. There's one other area that I want to ask you about. You talked about both commitment traps and boundaries. And in the interest of time, I think the one that I want to focus on is boundaries. You say that boundaries are like the walls of a sandcastle. The second we let one fall over, the rest of them come crashing down. And, you know, it's funny because I think that, you know, I remember writing an article about this after working with a dating coach. I said, you know, if I could go back and find one pattern between all of my relationships, it was a complete lack of boundaries and the fact that I would spend money that I didn't have to, you know, out of fear that the relationship would end, you know, do things I didn't want to do. And I saw that that had actually played out in virtually every other area of my life. Like I had no boundaries with my mother. I think the thing that I wonder when it comes to boundaries is, people often fear communicating their boundaries out of rocking the boat. And sometimes they communicate the boundaries and the response ends up being negative. And they're like, shit, I'm not doing that again.
Yes. I think that, well, we have to begin any conversation about boundaries with an awareness that we live in a world of trade-offs. There's no path that you can choose X where you're not also saying Y, it was saying no to A, B, and C, right? You everything is a trade-off. So if you say, I'm going to say yes to everything from this person, I'm going to have no boundaries so that things will go really well with them. Okay, fine. You can make the decision with that logic in mind. But the reality is that you've made a trade-off right there. You have made trade-offs. And one of the trade-offs you've made in the moment of setting your relationship up that way is that you're going to be violated. Because at some point, there'll be something that you feel like saying no to that actually hurts you. At first, it maybe just pinches you a bit, but actually at some point violates something really quite meaningful to you or deep with you. Or maybe it's just a thousand cuts. It's just a bit at a time, the violation just bit by bit. Eventually, you're going to be in a situation where you're in a violating relationship. And that's the inevitable trade-off you make when you first say, you know, oh, I'm going to do anything and no matter what, no boundary relationship. And so this is what I want to encourage people to remember about boundaries, is that you're not making a choice between, well, do I keep somebody happy or do I cause a problem in this moment when I'm going to have a boundary? If you try to do boundaryless living, you're still going to make somebody upset. You're still going to be upset yourself. So that's not even, you know, this perfect optimal path that doesn't really exist. So now you need to get to the more honest place of like the only possible viable long-term relationship will be one in which there are boundaries. Healthy boundaries, yes, some give and take, yes, some flexibility. But for sure, there will be boundaries. There will be things that work for you and don't work for you, things that work for them and don't work for them. And if you can find enough overlap between those things, then you can maintain a relationship. If you can't, then there isn't a relationship that can be sustained. It will ultimately discombobulate. And so it will be in a really damaging way. Let me give you a positive version of what I'm describing here. So I was just, actually, I just reached out to her again, but years ago I'd spoken to a woman named Cynthia. And she said that she told me a story of when she was 12 years old and her father and her had planned this whole trip to San Francisco together. And they had been anticipating it, looking forward to it for, you know, months. They would talk about it. Oh, it was going to be so fun. Every part of it was designed. Her father was going to be at a conference through the day at the hotel. Then she was going to meet him, early evening, and they were going to spend the entire rest of the time together. They were going to go to to Little China and eat food there. They were going to go to the movies, you know, catch a flick. They're going to go swim in the pool at the hotel. His dad was famous for going in even after hours and going to swim. And they're going to go back to the hotel, watch another movie, get ice cream sundaes. I mean, the whole thing had been designed and imagined, and they were looking forward to it. Everything's going according to plan until at the end of this conference that her father's been attending, she meets him back of the room, and just as they're about to leave, one of his old friends and colleagues suddenly turns up and says, "Oh, I'm so glad that you're working with the company now. It's so exciting because my wife and I, we've set aside our evening. We want to take you right now. We're going to go to the wharf for a splendid, seafood dinner overlooking the wharf. It's going to be amazing. And of course, Cynthia, bring Cynthia with us. It'll be marvelous. We'll do it. Let's go." And for just a heartbeat, Cynthia's like, "Well, what's going to happen, right? Like, everything's gone. I don't even like seafood. I'm going to sit at this table, going to be bored because they're going to do adult conversation." And just in this moment of, anticipatory loss, she says, her father says, "Oh, that would be so great to be with you and to do that, but not tonight. I've got the whole evening planned with my daughter back to back." And he just grabs her by the hand and they just whisks her out, and they do that whole evening exactly as planned. It's poignant that that Cynthia is talking about her father. Her father is Stephen Covey, who wrote Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. It's an evidence of a moment where he was really living what he was teaching. He was an essentialist by a different name. And she was telling me this story just after he had passed away. So literally this moment had lasted now more than a lifetime. And in that story, boundaries are at play. It's a particular kind of boundary, but you can see that if he'd lived in a boundaryless way, if he'd just been open to every single possibility in that moment, he might easily have gone down that path. Instead, he put what was essential first. The priority in that moment was clear. He stayed with it. He maintained that boundary, and he was able to live his life according to it. Having boundaries, especially if we develop them clearly, so we know our boundaries really are protecting only the most essential things, can be enormously valuable in living a life that really matters.
Wow. What a beautiful place to wrap up our conversation. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Oh, it's one thing. It's to become less and less of who you really aren't and more of who you really are. It is a deep, for me personally, spiritual and sacred idea that each of us is truly unique, truly made for purpose, designed to be unmistakable, and it is a great part of the journey of our life to discover that, to just even have the thought that that might be what it's about. And then maybe it takes another journey to say, "Oh, I've got to get rid of all the things that it isn't. I've got to one by one eliminate that." And I'm with the courage that what I'm going to be left with is going to be special and meaningful. That there is a set of things inside of me that I'm drawn to that will allow me to play, a meaningful part in the great narrative of life, the great human story.
Wow. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights and your wisdom with our listeners. This has been phenomenal. I mean, I thought I would learn a lot from you from having read the book, but this exceeded all of my expectations. Where can people find out more about you, your work, the book, and everything else that you're up to?
The one thing I would say, and it would be appropriate for me to have one place, wouldn't it, as an essentialist, all that, but just essentialism.com. For right now, there's a couple of things people can do there that would be, I think, immediately relevant. There's a 1 minute Wednesday that we just started as a tool, a very short once a week newsletter that gives you something you can do in just about a minute too, to be more essentialist. So really achievable. There's the new podcast, and people can subscribe there as well. But then just in the future, we intend to have an online essentialism class, and beyond that, a community. And so it's a place that there's a whole intent behind that single place and single location. So that's what I would say.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.